So, we're now on the second part of our Jews Who Changed Jewish History class. And our topic tonight, our focus tonight, is on Rav Cook. Okay, Rav Avram Yitzchak Cook. Abraham Isaac Cook.
It's a K, right?
With a K. Cook with a K.
I tried to look up his name one time. With a C, I had a hard time.
Yeah. Good point. That won't get you where you need to go. So Rav Cook was born in 1865 in the town of Gorivah, which was in the Courland Governorate of the Russian Empire, basically part of Latvia. We'll just call it Latvia. Oldest of eight children. His father was Rabbi Shlomo Zalman HaKook, a Kohen Cook, and he was raised in a rabbinic family. He started off having kind of the upbringing of your typical yeshiva boy of his era. He grew up and began to show strong scholarship skills, very intellectual, very smart. And so he entered the Volozhin Yeshiva. Okay, the Volozhin Yeshiva was considered during his time in the Lithuanian world. And Lithuanian world was basically represented. That usually means the non-Hasidic Orthodox groups.
Litvak,
right. So Litvak comes from Lithuanians, which refers to a Ashkenazi style of Judaism that's not Hasidic. Okay, and that was typically known to be more intellectual, somewhat even dry, one might say. Which is kind of the Ashkenazi culture, right? Ashkenazi culture, not Hasidic culture, is not known to be as emotional or as it's a little bit more cynical, it's a little bit more intellectual, it's a little bit more, you know, it can be cold at times as well, okay? So that style, you know, the Eastern European Jews, basically, even Al-Hasidim were the same way. So he grows up in that world. And he joins the Volozhin Yeshiva at the age of 18. And the yeshiva at the time is led by a rabbi by the name, the acronym of the Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. Okay. So the Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Yehuda Tzvi Berlin, or Netziv, the newness of that, Naftali Tzvi, sorry, Tzvi Yehuda, I did that backwards, Berlin. So that's how it's supposed to be, Netziv.
Why is Berlin in his name? Is he born in Berlin?
I don't know. That's a good question. We can look it up. I'm not sure. So, the Netziv was a leader of the yeshiva and was, you know, one leading rabbis of his generation. And he wrote a few different texts. His most famous text is probably something called the Hamek Davar, which is a commentary on Chumash. But he wrote a number of different texts on Talmud, response, all these different things. So he's heading up the Volozhin Yeshiva. For Tom?
For you.
I don't need. I'm okay.
Okay.
So he joins at the age of 18. Okay, and the story goes that the Netziv said about him that if he had been the only student they ever produced, it would have been worth building the yeshiva just for him. The Netziv didn't say build the yeshiva, but he had run the yeshiva for many years, and he was so impressed by Rav Cook. You know, he wasn't Rav then, he was just little Yitzi, whatever they called him. So he was so impressive that, you know, if they built the yeshiva just for him, that would have been fine. He marries to your... Sorry?
Did Netziv live with in the 1900s?
What year did he die, you mean, Netziv? I think he lived in the
1900s. I mean, did he know what Rav Cook became?
Ended up becoming? All right, now we're going to look at Netziv's...
Because, you know, the Derek in those days was not exactly what Rav Cook became.
Well, we'll talk about what Rav Cook became and how it was different. Let's see, the Netziv dies in... Okay. 1893. So no, he didn't really see it. 1816 to 1893.
Mm-hmm. That's a pretty good age for that time.
Yeah, sure.
He lived how old was he?
1816 to 1893. Oh, 77. Yeah, so he had a nice long life. Certainly, like you said, certainly for that time. So again, he starts off being, you know, he follows the regular path. He becomes a rabbi in a small town in Lithuania. He marries, and he, you know, he has some tragedy early in his life. I can't focus too much on his personal life. His first wife dies, and then he ends up marrying, you know, her cousin. And again, he, you know, he's moving up to different rabbinic posts throughout Eastern Europe, and he's beginning to see that in the land of Israel there is a lot happening, right? The first Aliyah started, and Jews are beginning to immigrate back to Israel. It's still very early, very, very early, and very little has been built up. And the Jews of Eastern Europe have not really been inclined to leave, right? In Russia, some Jews left the pogroms. Some came to America. Maybe some came to Israel, but...
A lot came to America,
yeah. Fine, yeah. But where he was...
When was this? What year?
Let's see. Well, he first goes to Israel in the year. Um. 1904. Okay, so very early on, he moves to Israel, and he is at that. He would say he's born.
65.
He was born in 65.
He's 39.
Okay. Yeah. So he really changes course from the rest of his contemporaries, and that he actively wants to go to Israel. Now, he wants to go to Israel at a younger age, okay? And he wants to just go there and settle there and find his way. And his father, I think his father-in-law, tells him, don't do that. Build up your reputation, build up, you know, and then wait for them to invite you. Wait for them to, you know, ask you to come. Because if they ask you to come to fill a rabbinic post, so then you've got standing. Now you're coming in with some credibility. If you just show up there, no one knows who you are at a young age, and then work your way up, so then, you know, maybe they figure out, maybe you don't. You want to come in with some credibility from the outset. Okay, that's what advice he gets. And it probably was good advice. So he's writing, and he's publishing, and he's writing a lot about the land of Israel, so he's making it clear that that he's got a certain desire to be connected to the land of Israel. And finally, he's invited as the chief rabbi of Jaffa, and he goes there in 1904.
For a job, right?
To be chief rabbi of the city, yeah. It wasn't a huge city, but it was a poor town, an agricultural town. Now, predominantly, the Jews who are living in Israel at that time are very secular, okay? And many of them are fleeing the religious life they grew up in, okay? And the Zionist movement, from the outset, had a very strong secular and political component to it, and not a whole lot of religious component to it. And even though you had certain rabbis of the era who really were very pro, I mean, everyone's pro-Israel, right? You had to meet a rabbi who's anti-Israel. But some focus on more than others. And the truth is, as has happened throughout Jewish history, Jews had been in Eastern Europe for a good 900 years, right? So, Israel was still a dream far away. That's a Messiah problem. How does that affect us today? We got to deal with our lives. So the Jews of Lithuania, you know, in Eastern Europe, weren't exactly preoccupied with Israel. But as Jews began to make their way there, and the message was getting back that there are people actually kind of rebuilding the land, so slowly but surely there began to be, you know, political movements, youth groups, things like that. But there hadn't really been major rabbis who had joined the fray, right? It had mostly just been secular, you know, people who want to build up the land. So where Rav Kook really diverted from his contemporaries is that he decided that he wanted to join this and help build it. Okay? Way before his time. Again, 1904, right? We're 34 years from Kristallnacht, right? So, you know, it's not like this is a response to the Holocaust or the Nazis. It's way before that. And this is where we get into the people that changed Jewish history, and we talked about this a lot last week with the Rambam, was they have a unique ability to see the future. That's what it comes down to. And not only see the future, but then act upon it. Right. So we talked about some of the things that the Rambam did, some of the books that he wrote, some of the focuses that he had that were well ahead of his time. And whenever you're ahead of your time, you're going to be somewhat looked upon by your contemporaries as being different and what?
Crazy.
Or, you know, leaving the fold or, you know, doing something different. So Rav Kook did that. Again, not many of his contemporaries did. There are a few others that do that down the road.
After him?
Well, most famously, I think, the Slobodka Yeshiva. The Slobodka Yeshiva was kind of an offshoot of the Volozhin Yeshiva. And the Slobodka Yeshiva then becomes the smaller place, but it becomes the training ground for the leading rabbis of the time that led into the, you know, well through the 20th century. And in the 1920s, I want to say, maybe 27, 28, I have to check the exact time. So the head of the yeshiva, the altar of Slobodka, fascinating man. Another fascinating man, way ahead of his time. And he just decides that the future is in Israel. And we have to leave. Right? We have to leave. And he picks up the entire yeshiva and says, we're going to Israel. About, I think about two-thirds go, one-third doesn't go. And they go to Hebron. That's where they go, to Hebron.
The Hebron Yeshiva is...
The Hebron Yeshiva is the Slobodka Yeshiva. Uh-huh. So they go to Hebron, and pretty soon after they get there, there's a massacre in Hebron, which is a whole other story, but there's Arabs attacking Jews, and about 35, 40 Jews, I think, were killed. And they ended up moving to Jerusalem from Hebron because it was too dangerous. But it's still known today as the Hebron Yeshiva, and it's still a very big yeshiva in Israel. So the Slobodka Yeshiva lives on through the fact, because they were ahead of their time, and they realized that they had to go to Israel. So, but that's already, that's a good 20, 25 years after Rav Kook. Okay, so they had a lot more time to see what was happening. What Rav Kook does is unprecedented.
But did they have contact, the Slobodka Yeshiva, with Rav Kook?
I assume so. I don't know. I don't know.
When did the ultra-orthodox, I mean, ultra-religious, when?
When did they go to Israel?
Yeah.
I don't know, 20 years ago. No, there in Jerusalem, there was always a contingent of Orthodox Jews, very Orthodox Jews. That changes over time, socially, politically, culturally, that changes. The ultra-Orthodox Jew of today is very different than it was.
When these people get there?
Which people?
Which is over there now and giving people a problem.
Oh, the people in Beit Shemesh?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the whole town of Ramat Beit Shemesh is not even, maybe it's 10 years old. you know, everywhere, you know, it's Jews, it's descendants of Jews that come after the Holocaust, before the Holocaust, yeah. Americans.
How many numbers?
I don't know exactly. But yeah. There is not really an observant community that moves to Israel for a long time. Again, in Jerusalem, there was always a contingent that, you know, traced back, you know, 10 generations. But, you know, most come either, you know, but right before or after the war. You know, after the war. And there are very few people who show up in Israel and are very observant Jews in the, you know, teens, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. Very, very few. There's a religious revival to a certain extent, and then there's Jews that move from other areas that, you know, during more peaceful times. But, you know, it was a much, you know, famously when Ben Gurion creates this yeshiva exemption, right? So the yeshiva exemption is that Ben Gurion signs into law that any boy who's in yeshiva is exempt from being in the army. Okay, and that's a law that still stands today, and creates a lot of problems. So
I don't think he ever anticipated there'd be so many.
Right. So why did Ben Gurion sign this into law? So again,
religion would disappear more.
Right. The story goes that Ben Gurion, there's a very small religious community in his time. You know, the yeshivas were small, and he thought it would be a concession to the yeshivas. It would, you know, create peace or whatever his intentions were. But he never thought it would be a big deal because he thought the yeshivas would die out or stay small because the future of Israel was in,
socialism.
You know, socialism, kibbutzim, you know, a secular mentality. And he just, you know, he was convinced. So, you know, he didn't, in that sense, he didn't see the future. But Rav Kook shows up in 1904. And is in this very secular town. It's a very agricultural town. And
Jaffa.
So he is ahead of his time, number one, that he even shows up there. That he even wants to go there. Right? No one's doing this. Nobody. Nobody of his stature that has his credentials is doing this. Okay, that's number one. So there's a certain idealism. But not only there's an idealism, there's a sense that something important was happening. Right? And that's, I think, where the real visionaries, you know, separate themselves, is that they begin to see the future. Yeah.
If they were so secular, why did they want a rabbi?
Well,
there were some people who must have been.
Yeah, I mean, that's still true today. I mean, that's the same story today. I mean, how many American or European or South African or Israeli Jews want rabbis, but still want to be predominantly secular? It's not that they wanted, or, you know, have nothing to do with religion. But they were not exactly, you know, what they wanted from the rabbi might have been very limited. But they still, you know, they still wanted somebody there.
But this is the whole city. Doesn't mean everybody was secular.
Not everyone is secular. It's a predominantly secular city. I can't imagine everyone is completely secular. I'm sure there's varying levels of it. So Rav Kook begins to see, like I said, he sees that this is the future. And he feels like a return to the land of Israel is now happening. Now, what, you know, the early Zionists are not doing it, like we said, they're not doing it for religious reasons per se. And they're not doing it to bring about the coming of the Messiah. That's not their mentality. Right? They're coming to build a new society. Right? And I think during that era...
To rebuild,
right. But I think there was a lot of there's a lot of thinking during that time period as to what should society look like. Okay, you had democracy, you had socialism, you had which becomes communism. And I think there's a lot of debate and discussion as to what is an ideal society? How should we live together? And I think that there's a young generation, you know, that goes to Israel to rebuild what they feel to build a country and a society in their image and with their mentality. Okay, and that's what, you know, that's very common with youth, is that they want to change the world in their image, right? That's what, that's part of a characteristic of youth. And so, what Rav Kook was so good at is he was able to really understand that generation, and he was able to understand what they were about. And especially with youth, there's a tendency by those older than them to dismiss youth, right? To dismiss youth as foolhardy, as having misplaced priorities. What?
Unexperienced.
Inexperienced, right? They don't know what they're doing, and they're, you know, or attributing all sorts of motives that might or might not be true. Okay, it's a challenge for adults or more experienced people to look at youth and not be condescending. Okay, that's one of the challenges of adulthood. Youth has its, you know, its impetuousness, and adulthood has its cynicism and condescension. So Rav Kook was very good at seeing the generation, which is really a generation younger than him at this point, and understanding it and seeing the core of it and seeing the good in it. And then really speaking to that. Okay? So he didn't come to Israel to take these secular Jews and missionize and convince them that religion is the path for them to go. Right? That's not what he ever tried to do. That wasn't his mission. That wasn't his goal. No, it's not what he tried to do. What he tried to do was to take the passion and the energy and the idealism of the people that were already living there and moving there, and then take that energy and put it within a religious context. Okay? And that was one of the brilliant aspects of Rav Kook. He wasn't trying to tell them, stop doing this and do this instead. Do what you're doing, but understand that there's a religious component to what you're doing. That's about God, that's about the Jewish people. And that was very successful. Right? I think in general, if you approach people that way, you'll be much more successful. Right? Because nobody wants to hear, you don't really know what's important. You don't really know what you're doing, right? Once you start talking that way, the brain shuts off, right? Nobody wants to hear that. Nobody. But if you're saying to people, you don't even realize how important it is, what you're doing, you don't even realize how important it is. What you're doing is more valuable than even you realize. There's more going on here than even you realize. Now you're building them up. Now you're speaking to them in a way that they're ready to listen. But it wasn't just a tactic. He really believed it, right? He looked at the youth and the idealism of his era, and he saw all these people moving from, at the time, the safety and comfort of their homes and their lives in Europe, moving to this nation that they had to build from scratch, right? I mean, there wasn't shawarma stands in every other block, and there wasn't Coke factories, and there wasn't running water. I mean, I was watching some stuff today of someone who grew up in the 20s in Israel, and he's talking about how, they would water the plants with the sewage. They would have sewage lines that would go into the fields, because they didn't have any water. So they didn't have any irrigation. So that's what they would do. I mean, that was how bad it was.
Spread disease.
Right. So again, and they had a lot of disease at the time. They had a lot of disease. So it was a very hard time. And it took a tremendous amount of idealism and energy and perseverance to even get this off the ground. Right. It takes someone to be the chalutzim. Someone has to be the visionary. Someone has to be the trailblazer. And he saw that energy and that idealism, and he wanted to tap into it. And he wanted them to understand that there was a religious component to doing what they were already doing. Right? They don't have to change their lives to be religious. What they're doing now is religious. They're building the land of Israel. And what could be more religious than that? Okay? So that was a very important thing that he did. And he began to create what became known as religious Zionism, right? He didn't invent the concept of religious Zionism, but the idea of taking the secular Zionism and adding a religious component to it really helps articulate an entire movement that is still very, very important in Israel today. And the secular idealism of the first generations dies out, right? Today in Israel, you don't have a lot of secular idealists for the country of Israel. It's hard to maintain. And when you're trailblazers, and when you're the first ones that already is self-selecting, a certain type of person is coming and doing that. And there's a power that comes with it, there's a passion that comes with that. And it's self-sustaining to a certain extent, because you're there at the beginning doing something important. But three generations later, when the land is and the country is built, and the government is set up, and the standard of living is rising, so what maintains the passion for this movement? Right, people aren't socialists anymore. No one's moving to a kibbutz anymore. The kibbutz life that exists today is not the kibbutz life that it was even a generation ago. Now it's a shtick, basically, right? The kibbutz life of today is something to test to send American high schoolers for 3 months to give them an experience, right? But you don't have people living on kibbutzim in mass scales. So there's some people do, but even the kibbutzim are not the collectives that they used to be. People are working in the kibbutz. People are going outside to work. It's very different. So that kind of socialist, secular mentality, that idealism doesn't exist. So what's going to maintain this country? Okay? So what Rav Kook really added to the equation was a religious component that was essential to keep the spirit of Zionism alive, because that's what was going to keep the spirit of Zionism alive, was a sense that this was a godly mission, right? That we are building the land of Israel for the Messiah, or just so the Jewish people are back to their homeland. And he really made, he was very effective at sending that message to all Jews of all walks of life. And today, in Israel, the religious Zionist movement is really important, because it creates the most passionate people for the, who support the land and support the building of the country and serve in the army. The best, many of the best army units are the religious Zionist units, because they're the most idealistic. Now, of course, it creates political issues with, leaving Gaza and West Bank and all that. For sure, because with that zeal and idealism comes a sense of, we're not giving back this land, we're fighting for this land. So it certainly creates political complications because of the different approaches. But the secular idealism for Zionism is very weak today, has been very weak for a long time. So that, in that sense, his creation of religious Zionism becomes essential for the land of Israel to continue to grow. Any questions for? Yeah.
How did the rabbis in Europe, who was his close friend, react?
Okay, good question. Okay, so another thing that he really adds to the equation is credibility. Rav Kook had the bona fides to get credibility from his peers in Europe. And that was also very important, okay? Because the religious Zionist movement was going to be a bit different than what was happening in Europe, and was not a movement that was happening in the yeshivas. But there was some, obviously. And Volozhin had its characters, and Volozhin had people who were socialists, and all different types of people. But even amongst the highest ranks of the rabbinate and of the Jewish leaders, the fact that there was someone like him there, who was from the European yeshivas, who had been in Volozhin, who had been in those places and was respected because of that, it gave religious Zionism, and it gave the land of Israel more credibility. And that's important. That's very important. It made it more possible for other rabbis to go. It made it more possible for other Jews to go. It gave the whole movement a lot more credibility, because back in Europe, they respected Rav Kook. And, no matter where you're from and what political structure you're from, you're in the ultra-Orthodox movement, you're in this movement, nobody will disparage Rav Kook. Nobody. And that's very important, because even till today, if you ask the, religious Zionist Jews in Israel, who starts your movement, and they'll say Rav Kook. And that still today gives it credibility, right? Still till today, because everyone knows that Rav Kook was, in that sense, untouchable. His bona fides were unquestioned. He was a scholar. He was well-renowned. He was well-respected in all aspects of Jewish law and Jewish teaching. And that gives it credibility till today. So that was very important. So I wouldn't say they challenged him or questioned him. If anything, I think it gave the whole, what he did, a lot more credibility. Yeah. Okay.
When did he die?
1935. Yeah. So he dies before the war and the immigration from the war.
He died before I was born.
Yeah.
He never seen me.
Well, that's the most important thing for us to learn. Well, 1865 to 1935. Yeah. So that's another pretty long life.
Was he born before or after the Civil War?
I don't know.
1865 after. Oh, sorry, yeah.
Well, it doesn't really matter. He wasn't involved no matter what. Okay. Now, he did have a 5-year span, because he would go back to Europe to speak, right? He wanted to convince people to move to Israel. He wanted to tell people what was going on back home. And so he made one trip to Europe, and then World War I broke out, and he couldn't leave. So he was stuck for 5 years in Europe from, what year is it?
14?
It was about then, yeah. Like 1914 to 1919, something like that. So then he's mostly in London during that time.
Oh, well, he's both there.
Yeah, he's what, in Switzerland and London then during that
what
time.
What year?
I think it's like 1914 to 1919.
Probably went there in 1914.
He arrives here just before the war, and then breaks out, and then he's stuck throughout the war. He can't leave.
In 1918, the war was
so over. He's in Switzerland, and he's in London. So he returns back to Israel, and then pretty soon after that, he's appointed the Ashkenazi chief Ashkenazi rabbi of Jerusalem, and then soon after that, the first chief rabbi of what's then Palestine. So he becomes the face of Judaism in the land of Israel. And then he starts yeshiva in 1924 called Merkaz HaRav Kook, which is still a very prominent yeshiva in Israel today in Givat Shmuel. It's in Jerusalem, not far from the central bus station. So that legacy still, you know, really still lives on. So let's just talk about a few of his, you know, his ideologies that were very important. And that made him unique. So he spoke about it. I'm going to go through. He wrote many, many books. So we're not even going to get into the books per se. We're going to get into a lot of the major themes he discusses that are kind of unique to him. Number one, seeing the holy in the profane. Okay? Not just in the mundane, but in the profane. And that was a big theme of his. That even amongst the people that were there at the beginning, right, and people doing, you know, had no respect for Jewish law, right, would eat anything, would do anything, which later in Israel becomes, you know, there becomes a real civil war, in some way, you know, still going on today between the different factions, religious versus secular, right, and there is certainly
it's not a civil war, it's friction.
That's fine. It's not a civil war.
It's not civil.
It's not civil. It's not a war. Discuss. Yeah. All right. There is a lot of friction, but part of it is the religious side looking down on the secular side, right? How can we work with people who don't keep Shabbat? How can we work with people who eat ham? How could we partner with Jews who act like this, who do these things? And Rav Kook never thought that way. Right, Rav Kook, he viewed himself as someone who built bridges. There's a great little story that I saw in a biography about him, that he was going to a town in the north, and in the stable there was donkeys and there was mules. Okay, which so you're not supposed to have different animals together. And they're creating mules, and you know, they're not supposed to have different animals that are bound together, different types of animals bound together to plow, things like that. So it was a secular group, but they knew the chief rabbi was coming, so they're a little bit embarrassed by it, right? And you know, when he came in, they're really ashamed and thought he would, like, you know, walk out in a huff, and I can't believe you would do such a thing, and what's going on here, right? That's what they anticipated. And as they walked out, Rav Kook said to the people who worked in the stable, and he said, "Don't worry. Look, I saw it. I understand what's happening here. But the good that you're doing far outweighs, you know, this one thing. So don't worry about it." Right? And he really wanted to make people feel comfortable and to see the good that they were doing, even though he knew the religious level they're at. He knew that they weren't necessarily serious about Jewish law. But he felt that, you know, that doesn't mean that they're all bad. It doesn't mean everything they're doing is bad. It means that, okay, this is the reality we're living in his generation. And he felt his generation, a lot of people have been turned off to Judaism for a number of reasons. And you know, we'll get into some of those reasons that he felt. But he felt that a lot of Jews that were turned off from Judaism, but still wanted to retain their Jewish life. Right? Still wanted to retain being Jewish and giving back to the Jewish people. And he felt that for them, Zionism was that outlet. Zionism was that opportunity. So in some ways, they rejected Judaism, but made their life about Judaism. So he felt that you have to embrace people who do that, because they are doing a lot of good. And he really wanted to seek to understand his generation. I think it's something that we need more in our generation, right? again, I think there's too much of looking down on people less observant than you. There are a lot of factors that lead to things like that. Doesn't, you know, you build people up. You don't try to knock them down. And now and because he was that way, he was, you know, really universally respected. And throughout the land of Israel, everyone really respected him. So he saw the holy in the profane. Even things or people doing things that, you know, typically you would think a rabbi would say, how could someone do such a thing? This is outside the pale of what we can accept. He never thought that way. He was able to see the holy within it. He also, one of his themes was the concept of the Jewish people being like this living, breathing thing. And, you know, the Jewish people were one, you know, one body with different limbs. And every limb has different purposes, and every limb does different things. And not everyone's going to be the scholar. And not everyone's going to be the rabbi. Not everyone's going to be even the religious person. But just because that's the case doesn't mean that you minimize the importance of the impact of the others. Every Jew has their role. Every Jew can give something back. And that doesn't, even if they're not doing everything that the Torah prescribes, even though they're doing very few things the Torah prescribes, they still have to be part of the people. And so that was a big theme of his, was that the Jewish people are this living, breathing entity, and you don't cut off a limb just because you think it's not important. Well, you know what? You never know when it's going to be important. So that was a big theme of his as well. So he also wrote that people have to realize that sometimes the less observant Jews can and will do things that the observant ones aren't or can't. Right? You know, he looked around the land of Israel and was saying to himself, where are all the religious Jews? Here we are in Israel, where are they? Where are they building the land? How come they're not here? Right? So he realized that this is the type of person that was going to do this work. This was the type of person that was going to come here. And the religious Jews were very content to just stay in Europe and hang out and live their lives there. They weren't coming. So he realized that, look, you have to appreciate that there might even be something about the fact that they're not observant that draws them to come here. And so it's clearly God's will, God's plan, that this generation, these people, are coming and building this land. And, you know, that's something that you hear a lot from you know, the ultra-Orthodox in Israel. You know, despite the fact that I don't love that term, but a big theme you'll hear about is that how could this state be, you know, be from God if, you know, non-religious people built it, non-religious people were in the first government, they're still predominantly in the government. And his approach was, these are the people who are willing to do it. These are people who are actually doing it. And just because they don't follow Jewish law, maybe to the extent that you would like, doesn't mean that they don't have a very important value. And we've seen, you know, throughout Jewish history, there's plenty of people who might not have been the most upstanding citizens in every way, but provide a crucial role, and there are certain times when they were essential. Yeah?
You know, I had a theory. God decided to make Reformed Jews or whatever.
They were Reformed Jews. They were secular Jews.
Secular Jews as the focal point of starting the state.
Yeah, what's that?
He divided into three categories. You have the Hasidic group, the non-Hasidic Orthodox, and everybody else.
The secular, okay.
So if you have a Hasidic group who is the Ben-Gurion of the day, the other Hasidic group won't follow because, my rabbis would lead.
Okay. Okay.
The non-Hasidic are going to say, well, we can't follow Hasidic. What do they know? And then another religious is going to say, we're not going to follow some fanatic. So no one's going to listen to this Hasidic. So you got the non-Hasidic probably. Let's assume he's the one. Well, the Hasidim are not going to go for the same reason. My rabbi is going to be the top guy. The other non-Hasidic rabbis are going to say, yeah, this is his opinion. I got my opinion, don't bother me. And the non-religious, I got to say, the same thing they said about the Hasidic religious, you can't follow them, too fanatic. But when you have a non-religious person starting, then for some reason, religious Jews are more open-minded. They look at it and analyze it better. And they don't say, well, they don't dismiss them. They know what the Torah says. They're supposed to be returned, so automatically they analyze it better. Why the non-religious will say, well, everybody else is a land, why not us? Nothing wrong with that.
Okay, right here.
That's my philosophy, why God
decided.
Theory.
Okay, good theory.
Non-religious at the start.
Good theory. Okay.
And they were the ones willing.
Yeah, I mean, of course, theory was they're the ones willing to do it.
You got that on tape?
It's on the tape. That was Neil Wilmuth.
Okay.
1718 29th Avenue. They can send letters of appreciation.
When I went to the Shomer HaTzaim in Budapest, we used to go there. And actually, I think when there was a holiday, they observed that. We had to wear a hat when we went there. So, I don't know, you can go overboard or underboard, you know, they weren't Hasidic. School I went across the street.
But what year is that? What year is that?
1948-47.
Yeah, so that's a really different era. Yeah.
And I know I went to a Jewish school. Across the street was a school for the pious kids. Constant fighting with them.
No, I mean, it's a different era. Like I said, the early Jews that immigrate to Israel were very anti-religion, right? Over time, that becomes less so, partly because of Rav Kook. So eventually, Zionism and religion kind of become more melded together.
Okay.
But in the early stages, they were very, very separated.
Why did they go to Israel if they were anti-Judaism?
They were anti-Judaism. The history was, they were anti-Judaism, and they were anti-religion as it was taught to them. That religion had been a very strict, had been very intellectual, didn't have, you know, especially in the Lithuanian world, you know, and that's what we'll just talk about now. The focus was on study and scholarship. And
excuse me, one of the reasons is a person had five kids, only the oldest went to yeshiva, the four others didn't. And that's created a lot of problems.
Okay, interesting. Interesting theory.
Because they couldn't afford it? Or?
Yes, they're going to come.
You know, they have to work.
They have to work. Right. So only the oldest one went to yeshiva, and the rest stayed home and pulled the plow.
Okay,
interesting.
And that created.
That could be part of it, yeah.
Also, life was tough.
Very tough.
Know, life was very tough, and they were looking to build a better world. There was land that, you know, that they could. I don't know. It all depends. I mean, the Rothschilds bought land.
Certain parts.
You know, certain parts of the land. But there was land there. There was land that had fallen fallow.
Right, but there was
opportunity.
You know, the ghetto walls were falling down. Right, in Germany they had already fallen down. In France they had fallen down. So the ghetto walls had fallen down, and now Jews had an opportunity to explore what kind of world they want to live in. And some of them wanted to live in a world that was different than what they grew up in and wanted to create something new. So that was part of the idealism. So the Jewishness was very important to their identity. Right? And you see that, I mean, the European Jews who immigrate to America, even those that don't really practice all that much, didn't practice all that much, still their Judaism was an essential part of their identity. It's the next generations that lose that. But, you know, they'd grown up in a world that was so Jewish. Everyone they knew was Jewish. They weren't connected to any other culture, right? They weren't going to become, you know, secular Lithuanians, right? That wasn't, this wasn't America. It wasn't a very attractive option for them. So it was a chance for them together to build something new within what they've always their image. So this was their expression. And this is what they wanted. You know. So that's the other thing that Rav Kook wanted to do was to reform. It's a loaded term to reform the education system, the way Jewish education was taught. He thought it was being taught in a way that focused too much on Talmud, too much on Jewish law, not enough on philosophy, not enough on history, not enough on theology. Not enough on the stories in the Talmud and the stories in the Torah as opposed to just the legal aspects of it. And he felt that certainly the Jews in Israel at the time really would have appreciated that. And learning about the importance of the land of Israel. So he writes a lot about the importance of the land of Israel. And he really tries to develop a concept of, you know, the land of Israel not just being, you know, a place where, you know, the country God chooses to give the Jewish people because, you know, he's got to give us something. He really tries to develop a concept that the land of Israel and the Jewish people are intertwined. We're joined at the hip. And, you know, we might be separated, you know, temporarily, but we'll always get back together. And so he really tries to develop that link, that connection, on a very spiritual, religious, theological level. And he does that for the people there, but also the people not living in Israel, to really make the case around the world that you should be coming back. That you should be coming back. And again, those that came back in the long run, you know, did well to leave Europe. Yeah.
No, and wasn't he also a vegetarian? Or he wrote a book on?
He talked about vegetarian. Oh, he was. I'm not sure. Yeah, he was. I didn't.
I never heard of that.
There's something about it. I don't know the.
What did he do on Yankees?
There's something about him being. I don't know the whole story. I've heard of it, but I've never read about it.
That's about where I am.
Okay, he also believes strongly that every generation has a purpose and a religious mission. And it's up to that generation to figure out what that is. And so he really felt that the purpose of their generation was to rebuild the land of Israel. You know, he felt that was their ultimate purpose. And, you know, the mission that people were sent from Hashem, that's what they were going to do. And he felt not just his generation, but future generations. Like, you know, he felt that almost history was calling, and it was time for this to happen. And when he saw beginning to happen, he wanted to be a part of it. And so that was a big part of what he felt as well, is that, you know, being tuned into history is important. And kind of knowing your place in history is important. And he felt that was their place in history, and they had to take advantage of it. And, you know, all of that really created, you know, it created a backbone for what religious Zionism would become. And it created a context for religious Jews to move to Israel and still be connected to the land. Because without Rav Kook, you easily could have had a situation where there was no middle ground. You had your religious Jews, you had Zionism, but there was no common link. But he really tried to bring out the religious, the kind of innate religious aspects of Zionism, and to desecularize it to a certain extent. And that's another thing that he believed, was that instead of trying to impose an entirely new philosophy and have it trump the existing philosophy, to see the godly aspects of the existing philosophy and bring out those aspects of it would be much more effective and ultimately ring true. And so that's what he tried to do. And, you know, he had great relationships with all the founders of, you know, all the founders that he were there when he was there. He was close to all of them. He had the respect, and it's his son and his grandson also. They have a very universal respect. And a lot of his students, you know, he because of his yeshiva, he builds up a whole new, you know, generation that can carry on this philosophy. And his yeshiva was different. It was different than the European yeshivas. They taught philosophy, and they taught theology, and they taught history. Right, in Israel they teach a lot more Tanakh than in the other yeshivas, for sure. They taught science and secular studies in the yeshiva, which he felt that was essential, that the Jews building the land of Israel needed very practical skills, agriculture, things like that. They need to know. That's what they need to be able to do. And if they're going to bring together the different worlds of building land of Israel religion, they had to know all of these things and then be able to bring them together. He wanted to also emphasize the importance of bringing back the agricultural laws of the land of Israel. Shemitah, Yovel, you know, letting the land lie fallow once every 7 years. You know, a tenth of the produce goes to Levi, all these different things.
Do they do it?
There are a lot of people today do it.
Even in the kibbutz?
If it's a religious kibbutz, depends. You know, it's not everyone does it, but he began to teach, you know, what these concepts were and what the laws were, you know. We'll talk about Rav Soloveitchik next week, but, you know, one of my teachers, who was Rav Soloveitchik's, you know, students told us, he taught us in class that Rav Soloveitchik said to them, you know, when he was a kid in the 1920s, learning about the laws of the agricultural laws in Israel, you basically were learning, you know, laws about living on the moon, right? It had no relevance whatsoever. It was, you know, no one lives in Israel, no one does anything in Israel. It didn't have any impact on them. But he, you know, they literally brought back entire aspects of the Torah from the dead, right? Nobody had done these things for hundreds of years. Nobody thought about this. No one was doing this. So he helped kind of bring this back and just bring out this whole world of our religion that nobody was doing or had done for many generations. Okay. At the yeshiva? Mm. Good question.
Eventually the secular leaders that came after him.
Okay, good night. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different offshoots of the yeshiva. There's
Menachem Begin was not in Israel when he died. He was still 7 years away.
One second.
Mayor Fund, I heard.
Here, the Rosh Yeshiva Fund for Cook's passing included Rav Yaakov Moshe Harlap, Rav Shlomo Ra'anan, and Rav Cook's son, Yehuda Cook, and Rav Aaron Shapiro, and Rav Yaakov Shapiro. And then again, some of the Lean Talmidim kind of create other yeshivas in the same philosophy. Yeah.
Actually, the reason they couldn't grow anything in Europe because Jews can. There was a long, long time they could not own land.
Right.
In Europe.
Right. I mean, it's not Jews from Europe or agricultural geniuses who would come into Israel and instantly know what to do. I mean, they were learning on the fly.
Yep.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing they were able to do anything, let alone to build an entire country. It's incredible.
They did pretty good.
Thank God.